Speaking on this program is Brother Winford Claiborne.
Thank you and good morning. Preachers of the gospel often discuss the moral and spiritual problems which Americans face. They may even seek to stimulate the hearers to want to use their influence to make a difference in our communities and in our nation. But one of the most, if not the most, numerous responses that preachers get to such sermons is, "What difference can one person make?" Such a response is understandable, but not excusable. We must not take that attitude. If changes need to be made, and they do, God will hold us, every one of us, responsible for doing our share. I am not being pessimistic when I say that conditions may not be changed regardless of our efforts. But to show whose side we are on, we must make the effort. I need not spend any great amount of time proving that conditions in America and throughout the world demand change, because most of you read the newspapers and watch the news on television. However, let me summarize some of the dreadful situations which should motivate Christians to seek changes in our society. Divorce in America is rampant. In 1976, for the first time in the history of our nation, the number of divorces exceeded 1 million. In order to see that figure in its proper perspective, let me remind you of two facts. First, when divorce statistics were first begun to be kept, just about 100 years ago, the number of divorces was about 5,000. In just a little over 100 years, this country has increased the number of divorces from 5,000 to 1 million. There are a number of counties and cities in the United States where the number of divorces exceeds the number of marriages. Second, the 1 million divorces do not tell the whole story. Approximately 10 million other people are adversely affected by the 1 million divorces. Those 10 million include children, parents, brothers and sisters, fellow church members, neighbors, and others. Family violence has become a national disgrace. Thousands of spouses and hundreds of thousands of children are abused every year in this country. Many wives have to seek shelter to prevent their husbands from beating them to death. Between 2,000 and 3,000 children are so severely injured every year by their own parents that they die. 25% of all girls will be sexually abused before they reach the age of 18. Tragically, much of the sexual abuse will come from fathers, grandfathers, and other close relatives. Abortions in our nation alone have reached the staggering number of 1,500,000. Worldwide, the numbers are estimated to be between 50 and 75 million abortions each year. By far, the most dangerous place on earth for babies is in their mother's wombs. In addition, thousands of babies are allowed to die because they are born with some abnormality, such as spina bifida, Huntington's chorea, Down syndrome. Old people who are no longer productive or who do not have quality of life, whatever that means, are encouraged to die. Some even insist that old people have a duty to die. Pornography has become an $8 billion business in this so-called Christian nation. $2 billion of that business is child pornography. Pornography does as much to devalue human beings and make them merchandise as any other sleazy business in the world. Little children who are used in pornographic movies are marred for life. Women are treated like animals and sold as if they were in white slavery. In fact, if animals were treated in such a fashion, the American Humane Society would register a protest, and they would be right to do so. There is no dirtier business on the face of God's earth than pornography. Many of America's public school systems have turned into jungles. Barrett L. Mosbacher has edited a very disturbing book with the title, School-Based Clinics, in which he gives the following information. Each month, 3 million high school students are victims in school, including 2.5 million robberies and thefts. 282,000 students are assaulted in schools every month. Each month, there are about 2,400 acts of arson in schools. 1,000 teachers a month are assaulted badly enough to require medical attention. Risks of assault and robbery to urban students are greater in school than outside. 500,000 high school students say that they're afraid in school most of the time. High school students are subjected to 525,000 attacks, shakedowns, and robberies each month. Page 184. When my generation was in school in the 1940s, we also had problems, but there was a great difference in the seriousness of the problems than those that are faced by many schools today. Mosbacher lists the seriousness of infractions of school rules in the 1940s in this descending order. Talking in class, chewing gum, making noise, running in the halls, getting out of turn, wearing improper clothing, and not putting paper in wastebaskets. I am not saying that these transgressions of school rules are not serious, but please notice the crimes of today's school children compared to the children of the 1940s. In 1982, these were the crimes of America's school children, in descending order: rape, robbery, assault, burglary, arson, bombings, murder, suicide, absenteeism, vandalism, extortion, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, gang fighting, pregnancy, abortion, and venereal disease. As all of us know, there are serious violations of ethics in every occupation and in every profession, and that includes preachers and other religious leaders. Bankers, lawyers, judges, sheriffs, and school administrators are indicted for virtually every crime known to man. Men who call themselves gospel preachers become involved in sexual immorality and then bribe the persons involved to prevent detection. Do I need to keep piling statistic upon statistic and example upon example to prove to you that we need some radical changes? You know it. I know it. God knows it. Are we just going to sit on the sidelines and fuss, or are we going to make some changes? Arnold Toynbee argues that civilizations are not murdered. They commit suicide. Is America in danger of committing suicide? All right, you may be saying, but I am just one person, and what can I do about it? Probably nothing, if that is our attitude. But one prophet saved hundreds of thousands of people in the city of Nineveh. The capital of the Assyrian Empire had become grossly immoral. God said to Jonah, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry against it, for their wickedness is come up before me." Jonah 1:2. Jonah was reluctant to go, but after the proper persuasion, he entered into the city a day's journey and began to cry, "Yet 40 days, and Nineveh will be overthrown." Jonah 3:3-4. The Ninevites proclaimed a fast, "Put on sackcloth, from the greatest of them to the least of them." Jonah 3:5. One prophet saved a great city simply because he cried out against their wickedness. The book of Esther tells the story of God's use of one woman in the saving of the Jewish nation. Haman had the same plan for the Jews in ancient times that Hitler had for the Jews in modern times. Haman arranged the plot by which all the Jews in Persia would be put to death. Mordecai learned the scheme and revealed it to Esther. Mordecai pled with Esther to go before King Ahasuerus to work for the salvation of the Jewish people. Mordecai commanded to Esther, "Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Esther 4:13-14. The courage of Esther should be a wonderful example for men and women in every age. In 1792, William Wilberforce was elected to the English House of Commons and remained in that position for 33 years. As a member of the Church of England, Wilberforce became disenchanted with the moral and the spiritual conditions in Great Britain. When he became a member of the English Parliament, England was one vast casino. Duels of honor were common among the English people. Children were forced to work 18 hours a day in the cotton mills and in the coal mines. Thousands of children died from exposure and overwork. The heroes of the day were highwaymen. Corruption in government was so widespread that it was not unusual at all for members of Parliament to sell their votes to the highest bidders. The English had the best government that money could buy. Wilberforce was not only concerned about these conditions, but he was deeply disturbed about the slave trade, which was a cancer on the body politic. This distinguished statesman saw his duty quite clearly. He wrote as follows in his journal, "Almighty God has set before me two great objectives, the abolition of the slave trade and the reformation of manners." Wilberforce's first speech to the House of Commons expressed his total opposition to slavery and his own feelings of inadequacy to accomplish the abolition of slavery. Please listen to a brief excerpt from his speech. "When I consider the magnitude of the subject which I am to bring before the House, a subject in which the interest, not of this country, nor of Europe alone, but of the whole world and of posterity are involved, it is impossible for me not to feel both terrified and concerned at my own inadequacy to such a task. But I march forward with a firmer step and a full assurance that my cause will bear me out, the total abolition of the slave trade. I mean not to accuse anyone, but to take the shame upon myself, in common indeed, with the whole Parliament of Great Britain, for having suffered this horrid trade to be carried out under our authority. We are all guilty. We ought all to plead guilty, and not to exculpate ourselves by throwing the blame on others." Later, Wilberforce made another speech in the House, roundly condemning slavery. "Never, never will we desist till we extinguish every trace of this bloody traffic, of which our posterity, looking back to the history of these enlightened times, will scarce believe that it has been suffered to exist so long a disgrace and a dishonor to this country." Wilberforce knew that families were being uprooted and sold as slaves in America. He knew that thousands of men and women, boys and girls, were dying on the ships which transported slaves from Africa to the United States. He would not give in to the economic and political forces which sought to muzzle this great abolitionist. Poor health forced him to retire from the House in 1825. Just 8 years later, July 29, 1833, the bill to outlaw slavery in Great Britain passed the House of Commons by a margin of 283-16. 3 days after the passage of the anti-slavery legislation, William Wilberforce died. Before he slipped into his final coma, this noble Englishman whispered, "Thank God that I should have lived to witness a day in which England was willing to give £20 million for the abolition of slavery. Some of you in my audience may be thinking, but Jonah was an inspired prophet of God. He had God's help in challenging the city of Nineveh to repent. And Esther was queen of Persia. She had influence with Ahasuerus that we do not have with our political or economic leaders. And William Wilberforce was a member of England's House of Commons. He even had the support of William Pitt, the British Prime Minister. But I am just a housewife, or a farmer, or a carpenter. These were important people. I am a nobody. If you are thinking in those terms, please remember that every man and every woman has some power, some influence, if we would just use it. I have to admit that you and I, by ourselves, probably could do very little. But with thousands of other concerned people, and with the help of the Lord, we can turn this world upside down. Let me tell you about Mel and Norma Gambler, two very ordinary people from Longview, Texas. The Gamblers had no intention of conducting a crusade against unholy, unreasonable, unreliable, and un-American textbooks. But after examining a number of Texas textbooks, they felt they had no choice but to oppose some of the textbooks being used in Texas. Dr. James Heffley, a professional writer, interviewed the Gamblers and wrote their story in an excellent book, Textbooks on Trial. A considerable number of textbooks are mentioned in Dr. Heffley's book, but I shall take time for just a few. The Gamblers were particularly distressed by a Random House publication, Many People's One Nation. The Gamblers accused this fifth grade textbook of being sick, very sick. Please listen to this one excerpt from the Random House textbook. No nation on earth is guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than is the United States of America. Go where you may and search where you will. Roam throughout all the kingdoms of the old world. Travel through South America. Search out every wrong. When you have found the last, compare your facts with everyday practices of this nation. Then you will agree with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America has no rival. Mel and Norma Gambler joined with James Heffley to write another excellent book on the problems with textbooks in the United States. Their new book has the title, What Are They Teaching Our Children? The Gamblers cite one textbook in biology published by Saunders College Publishing. It was recommended for adoption in the state of Texas. Please listen carefully. There is no form of birth control or legal abortion that is nearly as dangerous to a woman as pregnancy itself. Abortion was accepted and fairly common in the United States and Europe until the early 19th century. Religious and ethical opposition did not develop until some time later. The situation has changed since World War II, now that the danger of abortion to a woman is again less than the risk of a completed pregnancy. And abortion is, once again, legal in many countries. Page 69. How could educators or parents allow such falsehoods to be taught in our public schools? If time permitted, I could give you dozens of other examples of un-American and un-Christian teachings from the various textbooks which the Gamblers reviewed. But a very significant question is in order. Just how effective were the Gamblers in their opposition to textbooks in Texas? Did they really make a difference? Of this, we can be sure. They stirred a storm of criticism from the National Education Association and from various liberal media personnel. One news reporter from Panola, Texas, accused the Gamblers of operating just like the Nazis, the Klan, Idi Amin, and the Ayatollah. On the other hand, William Murchison, associate editor of the Dallas Morning News, praised the Gamblers for their studious, effective criticism of school texts. The Gamblers, he wrote in an editorial, believe in the goodness of America, the sanctity of the family, and the necessity for principled, upright standards of behavior. Page 6. Mike Wallace of CBS's program 60 Minutes read everything he could find on the gamblers. When he met them, he told Norma, "I know more about you than you know about yourself." Norma Gabler showed Mike Wallace some of the objectionable and offensive textbooks. Mike picked one passage from one of the books and asked Norma to read it. She refused. He demanded two or three times that she read it. She refused each time. Wallace then handed the passage to one of the Gabler staff members. When she read it, it was so obscene that it could not be used on television. Mike Wallace mentioned the fact that blacks, Hispanics, and feminists now want a say in determining what goes into textbooks. Then he said, "But there is one woman down in Texas who says that if all those assorted groups can have their say about their textbooks, then she wants the views of the silent majority, her views, represented too. Her name is Norma Gabler, and she is formidable." Page 6. Mike Wallace also interviewed Edward Jenkinson, then chairman of the Committee Against Censorship of the National Council of Teachers of English. Wallace asked Jenkinson just how important the gamblers are. He replied, "They probably have more influence on the use of textbooks in this country than any other two people." Richard Carroll, president of Allen & Bacon, a major textbook publisher, expressed this opinion. "In the last 10 years, they've become more and more of a force for publishers to contend with. Actually, a number of textbooks have been withdrawn from the market when the gamblers raised serious objections." After a public hearing on textbooks was held in the state of Texas, with the gamblers participating, the chairman of the Textbook Commission summarized the stormy hearings as follows. "Pornographic and anti-obscenity laws should be strengthened to cover some of the trash and filth called literature by some people and require removal from school libraries." He insisted that inferior textbooks should be replaced. "Publishers should be required to submit more copies of a textbook that is up for adoption if necessary, but should be paid for them, and that the time allowed between submission of proposed textbooks and the decision upon adoption should be lengthened in some cases so as to allow more study by interested persons as well as the textbook committee members. Most of the economic textbooks being used do a poor job of presenting our American free enterprise system and what this country has accomplished under it." Whether or not you agree with what the gamblers have done has no bearing on the point I have tried to make today, and that is, one person in a community or one family can make an enormous difference in the tone and atmosphere of that community. You do not have to be a professional educator or a lawyer or a doctor. You do not have to be elected to the city council or the state legislature or the United States Congress. If you keep up with what is happening in your community and want to make changes for the better, you can use your influence for good. You may have to begin by talking to just one neighbor, and then the two of you to talk to two more. But you can change this world if you are willing to try. Of course, there are certain steps you will have to take to make a difference. You must be willing to work hard to learn as much as possible about what needs changing. The gamblers read hundreds and hundreds of textbooks. They wrote letters. They made telephone calls. In short, they did whatever was necessary to provide the leadership which the state of Texas needed in the area of public school textbooks. They were willing to sacrifice time, money, effort, and comfort to do what they believed was their obligation to the children of Texas. Their influence, incidentally, has extended far beyond the state of Texas. When West Virginia had its long and bitter controversy over textbooks, the gamblers provided support and encouragement. I believe they also helped the Greenville, Tennessee families who sought to remove what they considered offensive material from textbooks. My friends, are there situations and conditions in your community or state that demand attention? Are you waiting for your county commissioners or your state representatives or your law enforcement officers to correct them? If you are waiting for someone else to do it, it may never get done. Determine that with God's help and the support of other good people, you are going to do your duty. But what if we fail? And we sometimes do. Would you not rather fail than not try? Besides, we must let our young people know whose side we are on in matters such as pornography, abortion, homosexuality, spouse abuse, and such like. Our young people deserve leadership and role modeling from the older generation. It is possible that you may not agree with what has been said today. If you have questions or objections, you are invited to get in touch with me. I am not trying to take advantage of anyone and would welcome any comments or suggestions from any of you. We want this radio program to be a cooperative effort. If you think of ways it can be more helpful to you, please do not hesitate to let us hear from you. Next Lord Day, our question will be, should not shepherds feed the sheep? We invite you to be listening at that time. Until then, may God richly bless you.